Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor, professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese, Alexis McLeod, and Sarah Tyson. Together, we bring you conversations with philosophers about their new books in a wide range of areas of contemporary philosophical inquiry. Although we always hope that New Books in Philosophy will be an interesting, educational, and fun part of your regular life, in this time of coronavirus pandemic and social distancing, we also hope that our podcasts will provide welcome relief from stress or boredom. My interview today is with Peter Carruthers, Distinguished University Professor of Philosophy at the University of Maryland at College Park. His new book, Human and Animal Minds, The Consciousness Questions Laid to Rest, is just out from Oxford University Press. Do non-human animals have phenomenally conscious mental states? For example, do they have the types of conscious experiences we have when, in our case, we experience the smell of cinnamon or the redness of a ripe tomato? In his new book, Carruthers argues that there is no fact of the matter as to whether they do or not. On his view, non-human animals have those types of consciousness identified as being awake or being aware. Moreover, he agrees that the mental lives of humans and non-humans share quite a lot based on recent empirical research, and he adopts a reductive theory of phenomenal consciousness that identifies it with globally broadcast non-conceptual content. But what is indeterminate is whether non-humans have the all-or-nothing, what-it's-like quality that our first personal concept of phenomenal consciousness appears to pick out. Nevertheless, he argues that this indeterminacy really doesn't matter much. In particular, it does not follow that we should not be concerned about animal welfare. There's a lot to talk about. It's a very interesting book. So let's turn to the interview. Hello, Peter Carruthers. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
I'm very excited to talk about your book, Human and Animal Minds, The Consciousness Questions Laid to Rest. Before we get to the, you know, the actual test of this book, maybe you could give us a little bit of background about yourself and your interests. I mean, this is not your, you've written a number of books and certainly a large number of articles on the topic of animal minds and consciousness, things like that. So maybe you can tell us a bit about your interests in these areas and then how this particular book came about.
Sure. So I've been working on and off on philosophy of psychology for now, 30 years, I guess. And I did a book on consciousness 20 years ago now. It was called Phenomenal Consciousness. And in that book, I defended a version of the higher order thought theory. I called it dual content theory. And then I more or less stopped thinking about the topic. I kind of lost interest. I had other things to do. I continued working on things to do with modularity and mental architecture and animal minds, and then on self-knowledge. And then I did a thing on conscious thought. And as that time was passing, I was getting increasingly uneasy about the theory I'd defended. partly that I just thought, well, there's not. It required me to make some assumptions that I couldn't really argue for. I mean, I thought it was giving the best explanation, but I was uneasy. And it was only a few years ago that it occurred to me that, I mean, I went back to look at the arguments I'd offered for preferring dual content theory over Michael Tye's sort of global access theory. And I thought, the arguments aren't that good. And one in particular brought me up short. It was that I had argued that Tye's view, the first order global workspace view, couldn't really explain why anything lit up when you moved from unconscious to conscious. And I realized that although I'd been offering a fully reductive theory, there is no such thing as lighting up on my view. I mean, there's no special properties or anything like that, that I'd been sucked into some of the assumptions that undergird people's belief in qualia and special properties of phenomenally conscious experience. And then once I dropped that, I thought, okay, so the best theory is likely to be first order theory. And I then started to wonder what implications that had for animals, and taught a seminar on the topic, and we discussed it, and I ended up writing this book because I thought Michael Tye had just brought out a book on animals, and I thought he'd got it all badly wrong, and I thought I could do better.
Okay, well, one of the questions which I want to get to later is you do, you know, defend a global workspace theory instead of a higher order thought theory. But first of all, we should probably establish, you know, when you're talking about phenomenal consciousness, you know, what exactly are you talking about? And there's a number of different properties there that play an important role in the overall argument, because as we'll get to, you know, you argue that there's no fact to the matter as to whether non-human animals have phenomenal consciousness. So you know, just to kind of get us started, what do you mean by phenomenal consciousness as opposed to, say, creature consciousness or other consciousness type phenomena, right? And then you also have, you know, you argue that it's all or nothing. You know, it does not come in degrees. And it's also a feature of mental states. Okay. So could you say a bit about phenomenal consciousness?
Yeah, so phenomenal consciousness is the form of consciousness that it wasn't introduced by Thomas Nagel, but he was the one who first really popularized it. It's the what it's likeness of experience. So what it's like to see red, to hear a trombone, to smell cinnamon. And I think everyone who's discussed the issue has always thought of it as a first-person notion, that locutions like, you know, what it's like, or the feel of experience, or the qualitative properties of experience, are all really to draw one's attention introspectively to one's own experiential states. So when I say, you know, an experience of bright red is like the experience of a trumpet, that's really just an invitation for you to introspect on the experiences that you have of those two to verify it from your own case. Other uses of the term conscious that also occur in English quite frequently, there's the conscious versus asleep, or conscious versus unconscious. There can be consciousness of a thing or a property in the world. And most of those are, I think, fully third-person notions of consciousness. There's nothing especially first-personal or introspective about them, right? That we can easily judge whether an animal is awake or asleep. You can judge whether a cat is conscious of the mouse scuttling towards its hole, meaning it just sees it. Whereas the phenomenal consciousness is this first-person one that applies specifically to to experiences, debated whether it also applies to thoughts. There's a debate about that that I've joined in on. And it's supposed to be phenomenal consciousness that gives rise to hard problems. I mean, so since Nagel's work, he thought that the contrast between first personal and third personal perspectives on our experience in the world was kind of created a kind of disconnect that was really problematic and deeply problematic. And then, of course, Chalmers in his book argued that the problem of phenomenal consciousness should lead us to think that there are special non-physical properties in the world, qualia properties that can't be explained in physical terms. And in part, we're supposed to get to that view by thinking about the possibility of zombies, that you can think to yourself, well, there could be a creature that's exactly like me in all physical, behavioral, representational respects, right? Its psychology is just like mine, except that it doesn't have states like these. And here you pay attention to your own phenomenally conscious experience and you think, so it hasn't got this, but nevertheless, it sees the world and it acts on the world and it does all the things that I do, and it even says, I'm puzzled by phenomenal consciousness, but it's all dark on the inside in some sense. It doesn't lack these introspectable properties that I've got. So that's the target of explanation here. Part of the target is to see, first of all, what the best physical correlates of phenomenal consciousness are. So you know, as you look at the way the brain works and the way the mind works, what's the best account we've got of the properties that line up with phenomenally conscious experience? And then you can ask the further question of, well, so what is it? Is it something non-physical or is it physical? And if it's physical, you have to respond to the hard problem thought experiment somehow to show how they can be explained away, despite the fact that what you're dealing with is a physical property that a zombie would not lack but have. So that's the basic problem.
Okay, so just to clarify, so a dog, when it sees a cat or something, it sees the cat, it perceives the cat, but it doesn't have any sort of what its likeness the cat.
That at the outset of discussion is an open question.
Okay.
Right? What you don't have is the same kind of exactly the same kind of reasons you'd have for believing it's got those properties that you have for another human. Mm-hmm. But you know, at a first pass, you might think, well, you can have more or less confidence in the phenomenal consciousness experience of animals as the degree of overall similarity between their minds and ours gets greater or less. So you might think it's more plausible to think that a dog has phenomenally conscious experience than that, say, a frog does or a bee. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and at the start of the book, I treat that as an open question. It's going to depend on what the best theory of consciousness is and what the best account of phenomenal consciousness is. So I end up saying, yeah, the dog sees what's there and is so, in this sense, creature conscious of what's there. But there's no fact of the matter about whether its perceptual state when it is in that state is like this state that I have when I see the cat. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so maybe we should start on our journey to that conclusion. So one of the things that you establish, I mean, you've already said that you know, it's a first personal notion, and we have access to our states of phenomenally conscious states, or to the experiences of what it's like. Through introspection, right? Introspective evidence. Could you say a bit more about that? I mean, one of the things that, that turned out to be very an important thing, you know, the fact that we have access first personally to our own phenomenal consciousness through introspection. Obviously, we can't introspect to anybody else, whether that's another human being or another, a non-human animal. Can you explain a bit about the difference between why we're able to get from this first personal introspective beginning about knowing our own or having being acquainted with our own mental states or our own mental states. And then the fact that on your view, we can, there is a fact of the matter about the what it's like for humans, but there isn't a fact of the matter for the non-humans.
So to get to the fact of the matter issue is a bit of a jump at the outset, because I mean that depends rather heavily on the particular theory I offer.
Okay.
Okay, I mean, let me jump straight into it. So I think the most straightforward answer is to, if one takes for granted that phenomenal consciousness is this first-person notion, and in particular, it's whatever gets picked out by the phenomenal concepts one can employ when thinking about one's own experiences, when one thinks about them divorced from their physical and representational properties. So these are the concepts that one would employ when I think a zombie might have everything I've got, but it wouldn't have this, right? So obviously I'm abstracting away from the fact that this is a perceptual state, because I've already granted that the zombie has a perceptual state, and I'm abstracting away from the fact that it represents whatever, a red rose, because I've already granted the zombie sees a red rose. So it's these sort of purely indexical acquaintance-based concepts that fix the domain of phenomenal consciousness. And then you can ask, all right, so this isn't a public concept. These are, in a sense, private, that we kind of introduce on the fly to think about our own phenomenally conscious states. So what fixes the truth conditions if I raise the question whether another creature has a state like this, right? What makes it true or false that another creature would have this when I pay attention to my phenomenally conscious state? Well, if there were qualia, if there were some distinctive properties picked out by these first-person indexicals, then I think it would be clear what the truth conditions are, right? That it'll be true that another creature has this if another creature has got that qualia property, whatever that is. It might be really hard to know whether it's true, and indeed there are deep problems of knowledge for anyone who believes in qualia, which is why you get everything in the field here from panpsychism, where people think that every tiny little particle of matter have consciousness properties, all the way up to people who think that it's restricted to human beings. And there seems no obvious way of resolving it. But if you deny that and you think, no, what you're actually picking out with these indexicals is just globally broadcast non-conceptual content, but not thought about as such, thought about just in the indexical way that you can do when you've got this state, then the truth condition has got to be a function of one's dispositions to use the concept. So the analogy I use, which is a first order concept, it's a concept about the external world, but I think it serves to make the idea intuitive, is another example of a concept that's in a sense private, that doesn't have public norms governing its use. I imagine, I suppose you've been offered a job in another city and you've accepted, and now you're on a visit looking around potential neighborhoods to live. And you walk into a neighborhood and you exclaim, so this is the sort of neighborhood we should live in. Now, I can imagine a case where there's no one property that you intend to pick out, right? So it's not picket fences or something that you particularly admire. But nor could you articulate all the various properties of the neighborhood that are giving rise to this disposition to say, yeah, this feels right? This is the sort of neighborhood I want. So take that concept now and ask, suppose I say of some other neighborhood in the city, or ask of some other neighborhood in the city, is that neighborhood of this sort or not? Well, plainly, this sort of neighborhood is not intended to pick out a natural kind. There's no public norms governing its use. I think the only way to answer that question is to, or what fixes the truth condition for the question is, that if the dispositions that currently underlie my use of the concept this neighborhood or this type of neighborhood were instantiated in that other neighborhood, right? If I were transported immediately there and the circumstances were otherwise the same, then I would judge it to be a neighborhood of that sort, right? That neighborhood over there would evoke the same dispositions, the activation of the same dispositions that currently are underlying my current judgment. And I think that's the right model for thinking about how one would project first-person or phenomenal concepts into the minds of other people. In effect, you ask, if the dispositions underlying my use of this experience were instantiated in the mind of that other being, would they issue in the judgment that that state is of this sort? Right? And that makes sense in connection with other adult humans, because all the background abilities are there that are necessary for thinking indexical thoughts about one's own experiences, right? You've got capacities for higher order thoughts, you've got capacities for language, you've got capacities for reflective thinking. But if you project it into the mind of a very different sort of creature, a monkey, say, it has none of those capacities. Well, let's suppose it has none of those capacities. We could debate at the margins, or if you worry about monkeys, we could move to salmon or something. So pick a creature that has none of those capacities. Then when you ask the question, if the dispositions underlying my use of the concept this were instantiated in that mind, would it issue in the judgment of such and such a sort? You're imagining the mind to be quite other than it is. So in effect, it's a presupposition of statements about phenomenal consciousness in other minds that they share the same architecture or share the same capacities for thinking and reflectively applying concepts. And if that's false, then the attribution of consciousness there is neither true nor false, right? There's a false presupposition underlying the very question. The presupposition is that it's capable of those kinds of capacities. If that's false, then the counterfactual is just unevaluable, right? There's no evaluating. Would the mind of the monkey, as it actually is, if it contained dispositions to think like I've got, issue in a positive judgment? Because if it had dispositions like I've got, it would be a different kind of mind. So that's the key argument for the no fact of the matter for other minds. I argue that it's sort of a mistake to think that there's anything substantive turning on this, because if you're a reductionist or have a reductive explanation view of phenomenal consciousness like I do, there is no special property here. I mean, there are special concepts. There's a special first-person way of thinking about our own experience. And that's what gives rise to the problem of consciousness and the hard problem and so on. But what you're thinking about is just globally broadcast non-conceptual content. And that exists to one degree or another in many different creatures. And you can understand the minds of the creatures without having to ask this first-person question at all. So there's, you know, if you say, well, we've got phenomenal consciousness and there's no fact of the matter about animals, is that a big difference? No, it's no difference. Or rather, the only difference that there is that we've got capacities for thought that they haven't got. There's no further deep fact. There's no light that got turned on when you transition from monkeys through chimpanzees and other great apes to hominins. There's just increasingly complex cognition that appears.
Well, let me go to the point about, I think you said projecting my disposition underlying my use of, this, when I'm talking about this experience I'm having. Just wondering how do I know which aspects of my dispositions are the right ones that, or the ones that matter, or something for this purpose of projecting to something else, right? So what I'm thinking here is something like, you know, it could be that, you know, I introspect and maybe I've got all these dispositions, and I am able, you know, on your account, I'm able to sort of project those dispositions to another human, but not to a monkey. And so the question is, I mean, if which of my dispositions really matter? Could be that, you know, I take the bunch of them, and that, of course, is sufficient for me being able to project to other humans. But it could just be the case that, you know, in fact, only a few of those might be necessary, let's put it that way, for being able to project. And even though I don't recognize that fact, I just sort of say, you know, anything that, you know, has these dispositions, and I kind of gesture in a particular direction, and will have it, that's fine. But it doesn't seem to follow that all the things that I'm gesturing at are necessary. And so it could be that. So I was just going to say, it could be that there are dispositions that I might share with, you know, a non-human, a monkey, and those are the ones that matter as far as projecting the.
Well, look, what you gesture at is not the dispositions. You gesture at the phenomenally conscious state. The dispositions are dispositions that underlie one's use of the concept that referring to that state. So, for example, one aspect of those dispositions that there's just no getting away from is that they require the capacity for higher order thought, because this is the concept in question is a concept about an experiential state, not quite as such, because you're kind of abstracting away from that, but you're thinking about your own experience. Let me recast your question in a slightly different way, though, which is that, I mean, I think there is an interesting question here that I don't bother to pursue particularly, because in the end, I think the phenomenal consciousness question doesn't matter. But you could ask the question, all right, so what exactly is required for employing a phenomenal concept? Right. What are the background capacities that have to be there? Pretty obviously, a capacity for higher order thought, because these are concepts that are about mental states, is a capacity for reflective thinking required. I mean, so I think that some monkeys probably have the capacity for higher order thought, but maybe they don't have the capacity to sort of think reflectively in a controlled way as we do. Who knows? Maybe language is required. Are concepts like this experience that one engages require linguistic formulation? Could a non-language using human think the thoughts that give rise to the hard problem, or form the concepts that give rise to the hard problem? I think that there are kind of hard questions there. I don't find them terribly interesting, just because I think once you see that there's nothing substantive that is going to turn on this, that if it turns out, for example, that all you need is a capacity for higher order thought, then sure, that'll mean that there's a fact of the matter about, let's say, whether chimpanzees have states like this, but not whether salmon do. But there's no special extra property that that means that the chimpanzees have. All the facts are just as they were. It just means the chimpanzee has a conceptual capacity that the salmon lacks. I mean, all the other facts about the minds of the animals can be just as they are, whatever one says about this analysis. So this is among the questions that I think, you know, you could raise from within the perspective I defend. I just think, what's the point? I mean, once you see there's no special property involved, we should just get on with doing regular comparative psychology and trying to understand the minds of chimpanzees and monkeys and forget about the question whether they're phenomenally conscious, because nothing turns on that.
Well, because, you know, it sounded like whether there was a fact of the matter as to whether there is a fact of the matter didn't matter.
That's actually a nice way of putting it, that there are going to be clear cases where there is no fact of the matter, right? On my sort of view, a salmon, for example, plainly has none of the conceptual capacities that would be required for tokening a phenomenal concept. And then there are going to be cases where it's clearly the case they have those capacities, adult human beings. And then there's going to be creatures, including younger or older human beings, where we're unsure, where it's unclear whether they have those capacities or not, or exactly quite. So those would be cases where, perhaps this is more a matter of vagueness than of failure of presupposition or outright neither true nor falseness. But again, I think there's no interesting question to be settled. You want to understand what the mind of the baby is capable of, and it turns out quite a lot more than you might think. But asking the question, but does it have a state like this, carries no extra, it doesn't introduce any extra property, whether the answer is yes or no, other than it tells you something about the concepts the baby can employ.
Well, maybe let's pursue this particular angle. I mean, you said, you know, it fundamentally doesn't really matter. I mean, nothing important turns on it. Which is an interesting thing to say, regardless, just because, I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, the Nagel, you know, the what it's like, and you know, the problem that's supposed to raise for physicalism. And of course, Chalmers, as you mentioned, the hard problem. I mean, we all talk about the hard problem, or at least some of us do. And it's supposed to matter, right? Oh my gosh, if something is or is not phenomenally conscious. And I should say, I mean, it's, there is a related issue. You might want to distinguish between saying, well, you know, for example, should we be dropping live lobsters into hot boiling water, right? And people think that's, you know, a terrible thing if they experience pain. And in that sense, people will say, of course it matters, right? So I think maybe it would be helpful if you could clarify what when you say, you know, nothing really turns on it, maybe you could clarify what you mean there.
Yeah, so look, you've introduced two things. So a lot turns on the correct overall account of phenomenal consciousness. And in particular, a lot turns on whether there's some special non-physical property of the world that is introduced with phenomenal consciousness, whether there are qualia or whether there aren't. Right. So it's not that I think the debate about phenomenal consciousness doesn't matter. I think it does. It's a big metaphysical question. I think, though, that we now know enough to resolve that debate. I think we know enough to know, at least to have reasonable beliefs about what the neural correlates of consciousness are. It's this global workspace stuff. And we have know enough to have reasonable beliefs about what phenomenal consciousness is, that it is globally broadcast non-conceptual content, because we can solve the hard problem thought experiments. We can explain away why we attempted to think the things that we think about the non-physical nature of consciousness. So all those are, I mean, that's what I tried to debate through the book. But once you come out the other side of that, once you come out the other side and think, oh, okay, so we've got these special concepts that we can use for thinking about our own globally broadcast non-conceptual contents. And it's those concepts that give rise to the problems. It's not the thing that we're thinking about, the contents that we're referring to when we employ those concepts. It's that the concepts themselves are disconnected from other physical and representational concepts, and so we can conceive of zombies and so on and so forth. So there's no extra property. There's nothing special in the world that first enters the world when you first got phenomenal consciousness. There is a separate question about whether phenomenal consciousness matters for ethics. And what I did in the final chapter of the book, while wanting to abstract from any particular commitments on the moral issue, because I think that's for moral theory to do, not for philosophy of mind, I did present a sort of challenge to ethical theorists. I mean, some of them plainly think that phenomenal consciousness does matter. Well, the challenge to them is, well, if I'm right, then there's no fact of the matter. Does that then mean that there's no fact of the matter about whether those animals matter? Or can you reformulate your philosophical views, your ethical views, in such a way that the phenomenal consciousness bit drops out as irrelevant, as it should if there's nothing substantive about it? In my own view is, I think that all the views that make sense within the broadly moral philosophy field can be reformulated in third-person terms. You can reformulate them in terms of what creatures can perceive, either in the world or about their own bodies, how they're evaluating what they perceive and responding to what they perceive. And then on some views, you can be sympathetic. On other views, you might have a moral duty to pursue the desire satisfaction of those animals, but the views don't require phenomenal consciousness in order to work.
Okay, so we would, given the right moral theory, we could still be perfectly justified in arguing that, you know, we should not be, you know, throwing the live lobster in the pot or something like that. I mean, that depends on moral theory, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the view I've got is, you can, once you know the psychology of the creature, you know its preferences, you know what it's representing about the world and about itself, and it then depends upon moral theory what weight you give to those preferences given the background capacities of the creature in question.
Okay. Well, let me go back to something you said, and I just want to make sure I've got this right. So you defend a reductive account, right? So this is, you know, there are no qualia, no special properties. We don't need to go that way. It's, as you've said, it's globally broadcast non-conceptual content, so it's a global workspace type theory. And then we have these phenomenal concepts, and you said that the concept is in some sense disconnected from what it is. Did I get that correctly?
Well, that it's an indexical concept that is that in a sense floats free of the surrounding third-personal mental state concepts. So when I think about, you know, pay attention to a particular experience of red. And I think, well, the way this is like could have been reliably caused by green grass, right? So this is the classic qualia inversion thought experiments, right? So when I token the concept this to refer to the state as I'm experiencing it, I can then hold this disconnected from the third personal concepts that I would normally use to characterize it, like perception of red or seeing red. Okay. And it's in that sense that it's disconnected.
Okay. So once we have this reductive account of what phenomenal experience is, what it's like, then in what sense does our phenomenal, our concept, matter in a way? Does that question make sense? I mean, we've derived these concepts from, introspection. We think it's all or nothing. We've got all these, maybe associations with the way we conceive of it. But none of that, but then we have a theory, and we've got a reductive theory, which says this is what phenomenal experience is, and to hell with our concept of it.
I mean, there's a sense in which the concepts in question don't matter either. I think that it's not entirely true that they're a kind of philosophical invention, but it requires something close to philosophical thinking to formulate these concepts. My own experience in teaching consciousness is that you sometimes have to work pretty hard to get students to see the problem, the hard problem, to see that there's any issue here at all. And in doing so, what one often has to do is say, well, look, pay attention to your experience of this bright red now and think to yourself, couldn't I be having this and yet what's in front of me is green grass or something like that? And in effect, you're inviting them to formulate a phenomenal concept on the fly. I don't think these concepts play a big role in anything in regular life. They've come to play a really important role in cognitive science, unfortunately, because so many people have got hung up on the issue. But they themselves are not particularly important any more than the supposedly unique status nature of what it is that they pick out is.
Yeah, so I guess that I find that a little bit confusing, because one of the arguments, the first argument that you give about the no fact of the matter for non-human experience or phenomenal consciousness is that there's nothing in our concept, right, this first personal thing, that fixes the extension for them. But if we have a reductive theory, global workspace, then as long as, that theory, maybe it identifies certain neural correlates, maybe it, there's certain behavioral, indexes, maybe, whatever evidence there is, right, for that theory, would apply, to other creatures. I mean, at least certainly in principle, and probably empirically. And again, that's either the theory, the global workspace theory, has them in its extension, so to speak, or not, and whether our concept extends to them seems to be just a non-issue.
So back to the thought that the very domain that we're discussing, phenomenal consciousness, is a first person domain. So the concepts that fix the domain, that fix the the problematic here are first-person concepts, the concepts that one can employ to think about one's own experiences, the what it's likeness, the feel, and so forth. One can, of course, switch to a third-person conception of phenomenal consciousness. I mean, in work I did with Benedict Vieux, we suggested that the best way to operationalize it in third-person terms is just it's whatever property it is that gives rise to hard problem thought experiments. Right? Whatever that property is, that's what we're talking about. And expressed in those third-person terms, then yes, there's once we've got global workspace theory, you can say now as we look across creatures have that property, the global workspace, to a greater or lesser degree. In fact, it's a sort of complex, cross-cutting, multi-dimensional similarity space, but to some degree, many creatures have aspects of the global workspace which explains the hard problem in humans. And again, there's nothing puzzling or problematic about that, and again, nothing turns on it, I think. It's only when you switch to the first personal concepts that the whole the problem of consciousness is supposed to arise.
Okay. So let me one of the chapters that we haven't really talked about is where you discuss, you summarize a great deal of recent research in a wonderful way about animal minds. The various capacities, working memory and meta representation and various forms of communication and so forth. That chapter alone is, since there's so much of this research going on, it's a great chapter to kind of brings together a lot of what's going on, what's been going on for the past, recent decades at least. So just in that sense, you summarize that, a reasonably, comprehensive portion of the work, or at least one that's representative, maybe is a better word. And you argue against what's sometimes called a discontinuity or strong discontinuity view of the type that I think Povinelli and some of his colleagues have argued for, right? So I was wondering, maybe you could say a bit about that chapter. Why you argue against a strong discontinuity view between human and animal minds.
Right. So, first off, I wanted that chapter to be there to make it crystal clear that I take animal minds seriously, right? That when I argue later on in the book that there's no fact of the matter about phenomenal consciousness, this is not some sort of neo-Cartesian view about human exceptionalism or anything of that kind. So I probably have more extreme views about the extent of mentality than most people, and indeed many comparative psychologists. So I think there are very simple minds that go all the way down to bees. So the question really was about, so we've got a whole range of different capacities across creatures. What then marks the difference between, say, even the most sophisticated creatures, chimpanzees and maybe corvids, since some of the birds are really pretty smart, and human beings? How come we've gone to the moon and they're still cracking nuts? I think a number of the answer to that is complicated, and for readers who are interested, I think the book The Secret of Our Success is a wonderful one. it's going to be a story that goes something like this, that we have capacities that perhaps enhance those that are present in nascent form or to some degree in other creatures, so capacities for thought about other creatures' mental states. We have prosocial capacities that again enhance or further push along the scale and capacities that are present in other primates. We have capacities for language. It's still an open question how much of that is unique to humans, but I think it's likely there's at least some aspects of the so-called language faculty that are innately channeled and unique to humans. But all of that is mostly taking properties that other animal minds have and just sort of pushing them out a bit. I mean, another example might be curiosity, which I think is a very widely shared motivation, but probably got ramped up in the human lineage so that we're sort of voracious learners in a way that other creatures aren't so much. And then from that point, what takes us to science is a capacity for cultural learning. I mean, when you combine together capacities for prosociality with capacity to read the minds of others and capacities to be like others, to imitate others, those things that all humans have as kind of innate instincts, what you get is the capacity to, when a discovery is made within a culture, it gets passed on reliably, and you can get a gradual ratcheting up of overall capacities there as inventions and discoveries and things that just arrive by happenstance do well and get passed on through a process of sort of cultural evolution. And all of that's equally true of hunter-gatherers as us, but you know, once you start to have large farming communities and you can have specialization, in effect you get thinking tricks or what Keith Stanovitz calls mindware that become amongst the discoveries that get passed down, right? So you get the invention of mathematical systems, and you get the inventions of logics and of in the end, scientific methods. And so you get a continual ratcheting now of mental capacities that aren't innate capacities. They're acquired from the culture around you, and that's why formal schooling is so important for us now, and extreme forms of specialization. So you can see a kind of gradual shift from, yes, hunter-gatherers are quite different in many respects from chimpanzees, and they're cultural beings. They accumulate inventions and discoveries, and so you get more and more sophisticated hunting technologies in a particular region. But then once you get settled communities in farming, you get much more specialization and things really start to ratchet so that you can get this ratcheting up the capacities of the species as a whole effect. So that's basically the story, I think, is the right one. I mean, I don't develop that in any particular detail in the book. But,
right. It did make sense given the claims about phenomenal consciousness that, in a lot of ways you think not, it's very much not a Cartesian type of, nothing. It's, quite the contrary. I mean, and non-human animals have a lot of mentality, right? Is there some aspect of the book that, we haven't talked about? You mentioned our theory of mind module and projecting mental states. And so there's a number of issues that we haven't touched on in the book. And I just thought I'd give you an opportunity to, is there some aspect that we haven't touched on that you would like to
So I suppose one that we haven't, which has been sort of bouncing around in the background of some of the discussion, is the phenomenal concept strategy. which is by no means unique to me. It goes way back to Brian Law and perhaps earlier. But it's the way of defusing the so-called hard problem of consciousness by saying, well, actually, it's really just a function of the concepts that get used in those thought experiments. It's not a function of the any special property that's being picked out by those concepts. And in order to develop that strategy, you have to say something about what phenomenal concepts are. And that's where I think this indexical acquaintance-based view is the right one, where the notion of acquaintance involved, by the way, is nothing. It's not metaphysically problematic. It's just when you've got globally broadcast contents, they're available to whatever executive systems enable the construction of structured thoughts. And those thoughts can either be about the content represented by the globally broadcast content, so you can think about the color of the object, or they can be thoughts about that state itself, and you can think about this that I'm undergoing right now and think about the experience. And once you've got those concepts in place, then all the thought experiments that philosophers get so hung up on open up, right? Because you can then conceive of zombies and so on. Now, it doesn't follow from this story so far that there are no qualia, right? But I think the simplest explanation is that there are no qualia. And one way of getting at that is to notice that when you characterize the characterization of phenomenal concepts that I've just given is a third personal one, right? That represented from the outside, you can say, well, a phenomenal concept is an indexical concept that you can token in the presence of a globally broadcast state once that concept is disconnected from other third personal concepts. And using that characterization, you can then see that a zombie would obviously become puzzled by the hard problem of consciousness. And it would be able to conceive of a zombie version of itself, right? Because zombies have all the same third personal capacities and representational capacities that I have. That's part of the story. So, of course, they too can form indexical concepts that refer to their globally broadcast contents. And if they're indexical concepts, they can be disconnected from the other third personal concepts they've got. And so a zombie will think, there could be a being that's like me in all respects, except it hasn't got this, where the this is one of its. And then once you see that zombies would conceive of zombies, you can kind of bring it back home, right? I mean, that I'm as much of a zombie as the zombie is, right? I'm just employing the same kind of concept and conceiving of a creature that lacks this, but there's no special properties involved in either case, right? It's both of us, me and the zombie, are both just thinking about the same state, the globally broadcast non-conceptual content.
Right. Okay, good. that was clarifying. Well, I think we're running out of time, so I'd like to end with a question about what you're working on now. I mean, are you doing further work in the same vein, or have you turned to something else? I mean, you have a number of different interests. So what's on your agenda for now or for the near future?
Well, for the very near future, I've got two or three papers out under review at the moment that will inevitably get kicked back to me and will need further working on. It's so rare to get something accepted outright. So one's on varieties of metacognition and playing around with an idea that Nick Scher introduced for what I call purely referential metacognition, and he calls non-conceptual metacognition. Difference doesn't matter much. But a kind of a way of referring to mental states that wouldn't refer to them as mental. So I got a paper on that, looking at signals of mental effort as one potential example of that. And I've got another paper out under review on trying to reply to Tyler Burge's critique of the infant mind reading literature, well, infant and child mind reading literature, and arguing he's got that wrong. But longer term, no, I'm in the post book sort of fumble around looking for new topics phase. I don't have anything else planned, but then I very rarely ever do. Having finished one project, I read a bunch of stuff and teach a grad seminar, and I happen upon things that grab me, as I happened upon Michael Tye's book on crabs and whatever it was called, the animal consciousness one, in the lead up to this, and I'll see what comes.
I'm happy that you took the time to talk with New Books in Philosophy, and I enjoyed our conversation. I learned a lot.
No, thanks very much. It's been a lot of fun.
So thank you again, and good luck with the work that is under review and whatever comes.
Right. Thank you very much. And you.
You've been listening to my interview with Peter Carruthers, Distinguished University Professor of Philosophy at the University of Maryland at College Park. We've been talking about his new book, Human and Animal Minds, The Consciousness Questions Laid to Rest, which is just out from Oxford University Press. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. This is Carrie Figdor, New Books in Philosophy, and please stay safe. Bye.